Hey there, get ready, because today we're going to unlock a secret code of the universe, the code of chirality.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we're going deep into this fascinating world of molecules and their handedness. And to guide us, we've got some excerpts from a college-level organic chemistry textbook.
Sounds pretty intense.
It is, but fascinating.
Okay, so maybe we can start by, you know, just explaining what chiral actually means. It might sound complex at first, but really it just means an object has a handedness.
Oh, okay.
Like your left and right hands.
Exactly. And what I find so mind-blowing is how this concept pops up everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Like from the spiral of seashells to the twist in DNA,
uh-huh.
Even to the molecules that make life possible.
It really is everywhere when you start to look for it. And, you know, it all kind of starts with this idea of superimposability. Imagine you have an object and its mirror image.
Okay.
If you can mentally place one on top of the other so that all parts match up perfectly, then it's a chiral.
Got it.
Like a plain coffee mug.
Right, like a simple mug is the same whether you're looking at it directly or in a mirror.
Yeah, exactly. But if the object and its mirror image can't be perfectly aligned, then it's chiral. Think of a mug with, like, a design only on one side.
Perfect example.
And this concept of chirality is fundamental, even to our own bodies. Our heart is on the left, our liver's on the right. We are built on asymmetry.
Wow, I never thought about it like that.
Yeah.
So, okay, if we zoom into the molecular level then,
yeah.
Where do we see this chirality in action? Where does it show up?
Well, it shows up in a special category of molecules called isomers. These are molecules that, you know, they share the same chemical formula,
okay.
But they differ in how their atoms are arranged.
Oh,
like
yeah.
Building different structures
uh-huh.
with the same set of Lego blocks.
So same building blocks, different arrangements. So I'm guessing that means there are different types of isomers then.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You have constitutional isomers.
Yeah.
And those are where the atoms are connected in a different order. Like butane and isobutane, both have 4 carbons and 10 hydrogens.
Uh-huh.
But the arrangement is completely different.
So those are like building a spaceship versus a robot with the same Lego set.
Yeah, a great analogy.
So what are the other types of isomers?
Well, the ones that are really most relevant to our deep dive today
okay.
are called stereoisomers. And here, the atoms are connected in the same order,
okay.
but their 3D spatial arrangement differs.
Ah, so the connectivity is the same, but the spatial arrangement's different. And is that where this chirality comes in?
Exactly. And a prime example is a special type of stereoisomers called enantiomers.
Okay.
They're non-superimposable mirror images of each other, just like our hands.
So enantiomers are like identical twins, but with a crucial difference in their 3D structure.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Are there any specific molecules we can look at to really understand this better?
Well, the textbook uses the example of tubunol. It has what we call a chiral center, a carbon atom that's bonded to 4 different groups.
So let me see if I can picture this. Mm-hmm. So you have this central carbon atom,
uh-huh.
and it's bonded to a hydrogen atom, a hydroxyl group,
okay.
a methyl group, and an ethyl group.
Exactly. And because each of those groups is different,
okay.
it makes the molecule chiral. Tubutanol exists as 2 enantiomers.
Got it.
Mirror images, but you can't twist or turn them to make them perfectly overlap.
So it's all about that 3D arrangement.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned earlier that our bodies are built on asymmetry.
Yeah.
How does this chirality play into the molecules of life?
That's where things get really fascinating. Most molecules essential for life are chiral. And here's the kicker. They often exist in only one of their enantiomeric forms.
Wow. So life chooses one hand over the other. Why is that?
Well, it really just highlights the incredible precision of biological processes.
Uh-huh.
It's like nature has a preference for a specific handedness when it comes to building the molecules of life.
Makes sense. Are there any like striking examples of this handedness in the natural world?
Oh, yeah, tons. Think about the smell of oranges and lemons.
Okay.
Those distinct aromas come from different enantiomers of a molecule called limone.
Wait, so the same molecule can smell like oranges or lemons depending on its handedness?
Exactly.
That's amazing. So that means our sense of smell is sensitive to these subtle 3D differences.
Precisely. And it suggests that our olfactory receptors, the ones responsible for our sense of smell, are themselves chiral.
That's incredible. But okay, if our bodies are so attuned to specific enantiomers,
yeah.
are there any instances where this difference can cause problems?
Unfortunately, yes. There's the tragic case of thalidomide,
Oh, yeah.
a drug prescribed in the 1950s and 60s for morning sickness in pregnant women. It turned out that one enantiomer of thalidomide was effective, but the other caused severe birth defects.
That's heartbreaking. So this handedness isn't just some abstract concept. It can have, like, profound consequences.
Right.
It really emphasizes why understanding chirality is so important, especially in medicine.
Exactly. Today, there's a strong emphasis on producing chiral drugs that contain only the beneficial enantiomer.
So how do scientists even keep track of these mirror image molecules?
Yeah.
Is there a way to even tell them apart?
Yeah, there's a system called the RS system. It's a standardized way to name enantiomers.
Okay.
And it's based on the spatial arrangement of the groups around that chiral center. It's like giving each twin a unique name.
So it's a way to tell these molecular twins apart, even if they look almost identical.
Precisely. Now, one of the fascinating things about chiral molecules is their ability to rotate plane polarized light.
Oh, wow.
This is called optical activity.
Okay. Plane polarized light. Can you explain that a bit more?
Sure. Imagine a beam of light where the waves are all vibrating in the same plane. When this light passes through a solution of a chiral molecule, it twists that plane of vibration.
So the light is bent because of the chirality of the molecule.
Exactly. Okay. And here's the amazing part. Enantiomers rotate plane polarized light by the same amount, but in opposite directions.
So if one enantiomer twists the light clockwise, the other one twists it counterclockwise.
Exactly.
That's incredible. How do scientists measure this rotation then?
They use an instrument called a polarimeter. It shines polarized light through a sample and measures how much the plane of polarization has been twisted.
So it's like a chirality detector for molecules. It can tell us which enantiomer we're dealing with.
Precisely. Now, what happens when you have an equal mixture of the two enantiomers? It's called a racemic mixture.
So a 50-50 blend of both twins.
Exactly.
Would that mixture still rotate light?
That's where it gets interesting. Since enantiomers have opposite effects on polarized light in a racemic mixture, their rotations cancel each other out. There's no net optical activity.
So it's like a tug of war where both sides are pulling with equal force and you get no movement.
Yeah, perfect analogy. And this brings us to an interesting question.
Okay.
How are these chiral molecules even synthesized in the first place?
That's a good point. If most life is built from one set of enantiomers, how did those enantiomers come to dominate?
Well, that's a question that's puzzled scientists for a long time. One thing is clear, though. In a typical chemical reaction, if you're just, you know, mixing chemicals in a beaker, you're likely to get a racemic mixture, a 50-50 mix of both enantiomers.
So in a non-living system, it's like flipping a coin.
Yeah.
You have an equal chance of getting either enantiomer.
Right.
But in living organisms, it seems like there's a preference for one hand.
Exactly. And that's because living organisms have a secret weapon, enzymes. These are chiral molecules themselves, and they act as catalysts. They speed up chemical reactions, and often they do so in a very specific way.
So enzymes are like master chefs in the kitchen of life.
Yeah.
They take these simple ingredients and assemble them into these complex chiral molecules with a specific handedness.
Precisely. They're really the key to producing single enantiomers in living systems.
This is all so fascinating. So we've talked about molecules with a single chiral center. But what happens when a molecule has multiple chiral centers? Does it get more complex?
Absolutely. It's like having multiple sets of molecular twins. The textbook mentions that the maximum number of stereoisomers a molecule can have is 2 raised to the power of the number of chiral centers.
Okay, let me see if I understand this correctly. So if a molecule has 2 chiral centers, it could potentially have 2 to the power of 2, which is 4 stereoisomers.
You got it.
Okay.
And this is where we encounter a kind of seemingly paradoxical concept, mesocompounds.
Okay.
These are molecules that have chiral centers,
uh-huh.
but the molecule as a whole is a chiral.
Wait, how's that possible? How can a molecule have chiral centers and still be achiral?
It might seem counterintuitive, but it all comes down to symmetry.
Okay.
A mesocompound has an internal plane of symmetry. Imagine drawing a line through the molecule, dividing it into 2 halves that are mirror images of each other.
So even though there are chiral centers, the molecule's overall symmetry cancels out the chirality.
Exactly. It's like having 2 chiral centers that are mirror images of each other within the same molecule. The textbook uses 2-barraquetabramogetane as an example to illustrate this. It has 2 chiral centers, but one stereoisomer is meso while the others are chiral.
That's fascinating. So chirality isn't just about individual chiral centers, but also about the molecule's overall 3D structure.
Precisely. And this brings us to the question of how we name these more complex molecules with multiple chiral centers.
Is there a system for that as well?
Yeah. We analyze each chiral center separately.
Okay.
Assigning an R or S configuration based on those rules of the R or test system.
Uh-huh.
Then we use numbers to indicate which designation refers to which carbon atom.
So it's like giving each chiral center its own address within the molecule.
Exactly. For example, you might have a molecule named 2R3S23dibromopentane. This tells us that carbon 2 has the R configuration and carbon 3 has the S configuration.
That's a very systematic way to keep track of all the chiral centers.
It is. Now, the textbook also briefly mentions Fischer projection formulas as a way to represent these chiral molecules, particularly those with multiple chiral centers.
I remember seeing those in the textbook. They look like kind of a simplified way to draw the 3D structure on a flat surface.
Exactly. They have their own set of conventions, but for now, we'll stick with our dash and wedge formulas, which are, I think, a bit easier to visualize.
Makes sense. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground with chirality in straight-chained molecules, but what about molecules that are arranged in rings?
Yeah.
Do they exhibit chirality as well?
Great question. Cyclic compounds can also be chiral, even without having traditional chiral centers.
That's interesting. How does that work?
Well, the textbook uses cyclopentane and cyclohexane derivatives as examples. For instance, 1,5-2-dimethylcyclopentane exists in three stereoisomeric forms. A pair of enantiomers, where the methyl groups are trans to each other, and a meso compound, where the methyl groups are cis.
So the position of the methyl groups relative to each other determines whether the molecule is chiral or acryl.
Exactly. The meso compound has that internal plane of symmetry, making it acryl, while the enantiomers do not.
Okay. And what about cyclohexane derivatives? I remember learning about their chair conformations.
Yeah. With cyclohexane, the chair conformations are crucial. We need to consider axial and equatorial positions, which can affect the molecule's overall chirality.
So even though the bonds aren't breaking, just flipping the ring from one chair conformation to another can change the molecule's symmetry and chirality.
Precisely. The textbook walks us through examples of 1,2,1,3, and 1,4-dimethylcyclohexane, showing how different arrangements of methyl groups can lead to different stereoisomers, including enantiomers and meso compounds.
So it's like a 3D puzzle, where even these subtle changes in arrangement can have a big impact on the molecule's properties.
Exactly. Now, another important concept is the retention of configuration in reactions where no bonds to the chiral center are broken.
So even though the molecule might undergo some transformation,
yeah,
the spatial arrangement of groups around the chiral center remains the same.
Precisely. The handedness is preserved, even though specific atoms or groups attached to the chiral center might change. This principle helps us establish the relative configurations of different chiral molecules.
It's like tracking the lineage of these molecular twins, even as they go through different transformations.
You got it. Now, for a long time, chemists only knew the relative configurations of chiral molecules. They couldn't determine the absolute configuration, meaning the actual 3D arrangement of groups in space.
So they knew how the molecules were related to each other, but not their true handedness in the real world.
Exactly. But in 1951, J.M. Bivouet used X-ray crystallography to determine the absolute configuration of tartaric acid.
That must have been a groundbreaking discovery.
Yeah.
Did it change how we understand chirality?
Absolutely. It was a landmark achievement because it allowed chemists to finally determine the true handedness of chiral molecules.
Wow.
Not just how they related to each other.
So it was like finally being able to see these molecular twins, not just in a mirror, but in their actual 3D form?
Precisely. It's a remarkable example of how technology can unlock new levels of understanding in science.
Speaking of technology, one question that's been on my mind is, how do you actually separate enantiomers?
Oh, good question.
They seem to have the same physical properties, so how do you even begin to tell them apart?
Well, it's a challenge, but it's not impossible. Back in 1848, Louis Pasteur made a groundbreaking discovery while studying the crystals of tartaric acid salts.
Oh, I remember reading about that. He noticed something unusual about the crystals, right?
Yeah, he observed that the crystals existed in two forms that were mirror images of each other.
Okay.
Like the crystals themselves were chiral.
Amazing. So the chirality was visible even at the macroscopic level.
Exactly. And meticulously, using tweezers and a magnifying glass,
wow,
Pasteur separated the two types of crystals. When he dissolved them in water and measured their optical activity, he found that they rotated plain polarized light in opposite directions.
That's incredible. So he managed to physically separate the enantiomers based on their crystal shapes.
Precisely. It was a pivotal moment in the history of stereochemistry because it demonstrated that the optical activity of enantiomers was a property of the molecules themselves, not just of the crystals.
So it wasn't the crystal shape that was causing the rotation, but the inherent chirality of the molecules.
Exactly. But unfortunately, Pasteur's method of manual separation isn't practical for most chiral compounds.
Yeah, I can imagine. So how do we separate enantiomers today then?
Well, modern methods rely on converting enantiomers into diastereomers, which, unlike enantiomers, have different physical properties that can be exploited for separation.
So we change the molecules slightly so that we can separate them using more conventional techniques.
Exactly. One common approach is to react the racemic mixture with a single enantiomer of another compound.
Okay.
This results in a mixture of diastereomers, which can then be separated using techniques like crystallization or chromatography.
So we're essentially tagging the enantiomers with different labels, making them easier to sort.
That's a great way to think about it. Another method is enzymatic resolution, where an enzyme selectively reacts with one enantiomer, leaving the other untouched.
So it's like having a molecular sieve that can distinguish between the twins.
Exactly. These methods have become increasingly sophisticated, allowing for efficient separation of enantiomers, which is crucial in fields like pharmaceuticals.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about chiral centers involving carbon atoms with four different groups attached.
Right.
But are there other atoms that can be chiral centers?
Absolutely. Any tetrahedral atom with four different groups attached can be a chiral center.
So chirality isn't limited to carbon.
Not at all. The textbook gives examples of molecules containing chiral silicon, germanium, nitrogen, and even phosphorus atoms.
Wow, so chirality is a much broader concept than I initially thought.
And it gets even more fascinating because there are molecules that can be chiral even without having any chiral centers at all.
Wait, what? How is that possible?
Well, it all comes down to restricted rotation.
Okay.
And the existence of stable conformational isomers called our tropoisomers.
Our tropoisomers. Those sound familiar.
Yeah, we touched on them briefly earlier. They're isomers that arise from restricted rotation around a single bond.
Right. The textbook uses BiNAP as an example.
Yeah.
A molecule with two naphthalene rings connected in a way that prevents them from freely rotating.
And because of that restricted rotation, BiNAP exists as two stable conformations that are non-superimposable mirror images, making them enantiomers.
So the molecule as a whole is chiral because of the restricted rotation, not because of any particular atom.
Precisely. And these chiral tropoisomers have proven incredibly valuable as ligands in metal catalysts for stereoselective reactions.
So even though BiNAP itself doesn't have a traditional chiral center, its restricted rotation creates this chiral environment that can influence the outcome of chemical reactions.
Exactly. It's another example of how chirality can emerge from unexpected sources.
This is all so mind-blowing. It seems like chirality pops up everywhere we look in the molecular world.
It truly does. And it reminds us that the three-dimensional structure of molecules is just as important as their chemical formulas in determining their properties and behavior. It really is. Another example of molecules that can be chiral without chiral centers is alenes.
Alenes. Remind me what those are again.
They have this unique arrangement of double bonds. It forces the groups attached to the end carbon atoms to lie in perpendicular planes.
Ah, so it's like each end of the molecule is twisted 90 degrees relative to the other.
Exactly. And that perpendicular arrangement creates a chiral molecule, even though there's no single atom with four different groups attached.
So chirality can arise from restricted rotation, as in tropoisomers, or from the inherent geometry of the molecule, as in alenes.
Precisely. It's a testament to the diverse ways that chirality shows up in the molecular world.
We've covered a lot of ground here, exploring what makes a molecule chiral, how to name and represent them, and even how to separate enantiomers. It's clear that chirality plays a crucial role in chemistry and biology. But what about our everyday lives? Does chirality have an impact there?
Oh, absolutely, even if we don't realize it. Think back to the smell of oranges and lemons.
Okay.
We talked about how those distinct aromas come from different enantiomers of limonene.
Right. So our sense of smell can distinguish between these mirror image molecules. But is that the only place where chirality affects our senses?
Not at all. It also plays a role in our sense of taste.
Really? I wouldn't have guessed that.
For For example, the molecules responsible for the sweetness of sugar and the bitterness of quinine are both chiral. Even the way our bodies process food and drugs is influenced by chirality.
That makes sense. Our bodies are made up of chiral molecules, so it stands to reason that they would interact differently with different enantiomers.
Exactly. Enzymes, those workhorses that break down molecules in our bodies, are chiral themselves. They often interact differently with different enantiomers of a molecule.
So chirality isn't just some abstract concept in a textbook. It's like woven into the fabric of our everyday experiences.
Precisely. It affects how we taste, how we smell, and even how our bodies process the substances we consume.
This deep dive has really changed how I think about chemistry. I used to think it was all about formulas and reactions, but now I see it's also about shapes and three-dimensional structures.
I'm glad to hear that. It's important to remember that molecules exist in three dimensions, and their spatial arrangement is crucial in determining their properties.
And chirality is such a powerful example of that. It highlights how a seemingly subtle difference, like the handedness of a molecule, can have such a profound impact.
Absolutely. Now, before we wrap things up, I want to leave you with a thought-provoking question.
Okay.
If life on Earth is based on this specific set of enantiomers,
yeah,
like L-amino acids and defuggers,
right,
could there be life elsewhere that's based on the opposite set?
Wow, that's a mind-blowing question. You're talking about mirror image life forms.
Exactly. It's a question that has intrigued scientists for decades. The textbook mentions the Murchison meteorite,
oh,
which contained a mixture of amino acids,
oh, yeah,
some of which showed a slight excess of the L enantiomers, the same ones found in Earth's life form.
So does that mean the building blocks of life, and maybe even chirality itself,
yeah,
could have originated in outer space?
It's a possibility, and a fascinating one at that. It suggests that the seeds of chirality, and perhaps even life as we know it, might have been sown in the vast expanse of the cosmos.
It's incredible to think that something as fundamental as chirality might have extraterrestrial origins.
It really is, and it raises this tantalizing possibility that somewhere out there, on a planet orbiting a distant star, there could be life that's the mirror image of our own.
Mirror image life, so that means their molecules would twist light in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
The sense of oranges and lemons would be reversed.
Right.
And even the very structure of their DNA could be flipped.
Precisely. It's a thought that stretches the limits of our imagination. But as we've seen in this deep dive into chirality, the universe is full of surprises, yeah, and the molecular world is far more intricate and fascinating than we could ever imagine.
This idea of mirror image life is truly captivating. It makes you wonder what other mirror image phenomena might be out there in the universe.
It's certainly a question worth pondering, but let's shift gears for a moment and think back to Earth.
Okay.
We mentioned that most chemical reactions produce a racemic mixture of enantiomers.
Right.
How do you think nature selectively produces one enantiomer over the other in living organisms?
Well, we talked about enzymes earlier and how they can act as chiral catalysts, speeding up reactions in a specific way. Could that be the key?
You're exactly right. Enzymes are the molecular architects of life. They can take simple, acaryl starting materials and build them into these complex chiral molecules with a specific handedness.
So they're like master builders who can select the correct handed building blocks to create the specific structures needed for life.
A perfect analogy. This ability of enzymes to selectively produce one enantiomer over the other is called stereospecificity.
That makes sense. So nature has essentially evolved these chiral tools to build the molecules of life.
Exactly. It's a remarkable testament to the power of evolution.
This whole concept of chirality is so intricate and elegant. It's amazing to see how it plays such a vital role in shaping the world around us, from the smallest molecules to the grandest structures of life.
I couldn't agree more. It's a reminder that even seemingly small details, like the three-dimensional arrangement of atoms, can have a profound impact on the universe as a whole.
Now, speaking of those three-dimensional arrangements,
yeah,
are there any other interesting examples of chirality that we haven't discussed yet?
There are. We've mostly focused on chirality at the molecular level,
uh-huh,
but chirality can also exist at larger scales.
Larger scales, like what?
Think about spiral galaxies.
Okay.
They exhibit chirality.
Wait, so entire galaxies can be chiral? That's mind-blowing.
It is. Just like molecules can be left-handed or right-handed, okay, so too can galaxies.
So there's chirality at the molecular level, and then chirality at this vast cosmic level. It's incredible to think about those two extremes.
It really highlights the interconnectedness of the universe. Chirality is a concept that spans scales, from the tiniest molecules to the grandest structures in the cosmos.
It makes you wonder what other hidden chirality might be out there waiting to be discovered.
Exactly. And it reinforces the importance of staying curious and exploring the world around us, always looking for new perspectives and unexpected connections.
Well, I'm definitely feeling inspired to learn more about chirality after this deep dive. It's opened up a whole new way of seeing the world for me.
I'm thrilled to hear that.
Yeah.
Now, before we conclude our journey into chirality, I want to bring up one more intriguing aspect of this phenomenon.
Okay, I'm all ears. What else is there to discover about this handedness of molecules?
Well, we've talked extensively about how chirality affects molecular interactions.
Right.
But it also has a profound influence on the way molecules interact with light.
We touched on that earlier with optical activity and how chiral molecules can rotate plane polarized light.
Right.
Is there more to that story?
There is. It turns out that chiral molecules can also selectively absorb different types of light. It's a phenomenon known as circular dichroism.
Circular dichroism. Can you unpack that a bit for me?
Of course. Remember how we talked about circularly polarized light?
Yeah.
Where the electric field of the light rotates as it travels?
Yes, I remember. It's like the light is corkscrewing through space.
Exactly. Chiral molecules interact differently with left and right circularly polarized light. They can selectively absorb one type of circularly polarized light more than the other.
So a chiral molecule might absorb more left circularly polarized light than right circularly polarized light.
Precisely. And this difference in absorption is what we call circular dichroism.
Okay.
It's a powerful technique that allows us to study the structure and properties of chiral molecules.
So it's like a specialized fingerprint for chiral molecules based on how they interact with light.
Exactly. Circular dichroism is widely used in various fields, from chemistry and biology to pharmaceuticals and material science.
Wow. So this handedness of molecules not only affects their interactions with each other,
yeah,
but also their interactions with light.
It's a fascinating interplay between structure and light. And it has practical applications in a wide range of fields.
This is all so incredible. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to see chirality everywhere I look now. It's like a hidden code that unlocks a deeper understanding of the world.
It truly is. And who knows what other secrets chirality holds, waiting to be uncovered through continued scientific exploration.
It's amazing to think about all the different ways that chirality manifests itself, from the way molecules interact with each other to the way they interact with light, and even on a cosmic scale with spiral galaxies.
It really is a remarkable phenomenon that touches so many aspects of our universe. And the study of chirality is constantly evolving with researchers continually making new discoveries and developing new applications.
Now, as we wrap up our deep dive into this fascinating world of chirality, I can't help but think back to that thought-provoking question you posed earlier. Could there be life elsewhere in the universe based on the opposite set of enantiomers? It's such a captivating idea.
It certainly is. Imagine a world where proteins are built from D amino acids instead of L amino acids, where sugars are L sugars instead of D sugars. It'd be a mirror image of our own biological world.
It would be like looking into a biological mirror. Do scientists have any clues as to whether such mirror image life might exist?
Well, while we haven't found definitive proof yet, there are intriguing hints. Remember we discussed the Murchison meteorite, mm-hmm, and how it contained an excess of L amino acids.
Right, the same type of amino acids found in Earth's life forms.
Well, that finding suggests that there might be a bias towards L amino acids in the universe, at least in the region where that meteorite originated.
So it's possible that the building blocks for life as we know it are more common in the universe than their mirror images.
That's one possibility, but it doesn't rule out the existence of mirror image life elsewhere. It's a vast universe, and there could be regions where D amino acids are more prevalent, leading to the evolution of life based on those building blocks.
That's true. It's mind-boggling to think about the sheer scale of the universe and all the different possibilities might exist out there. If we did find mirror image life, what would that tell us about the origins and nature of life itself?
It would be a revolutionary discovery. It would challenge our current understanding of biology and raise profound questions about the universality of the building blocks of life. It would also have implications for our search for extraterrestrial life. We might need to broaden our search criteria and consider the possibility of life forms that are chemically different from us, yet still based on the same fundamental principles of chirality.
It would be a paradigm shift in our understanding of life in the universe. Mm-hmm. And it all stems from this simple concept of handedness, this chirality that we've been exploring today.
Exactly. Chirality is a fundamental principle that permeates so many areas of science, from chemistry and biology to astronomy and physics. It helps us understand the structure, behavior, and interactions of matter at all scales.
Well, I think it's safe to say that this deep dive has left me with a profound appreciation for the elegance and significance of chirality.
I'm delighted to hear that. It's been a pleasure exploring this fascinating topic with you, and who knows what future discoveries await us in the chiral world.
I can't wait to find out. Thanks for joining me on this journey into the world of chirality.
It was my pleasure.